Today is Tuesday, July 28th, 1992. This is an interview with Leticia Hernandez, conducted by Maylee Blackwell, as part of the Hijas de Cuauhtémoc Chicana Oral History Project. Do your stuff, or I can do your stuff.
Okay, I was born in California, in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. My mother is from Mexico, mm-hmm. and my father was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. My first language was Spanish. My mom and dad lived with my grandmother and my great-grandmother. So I lived in the family with all my grandmother and my great-grandmother. They took care of me while they went to work.
What year were you born?
1950. I was born 1950. Okay.
When did you come up from Mexico?
My mom came from Mexico when she was 13.
Okay.
And my grandmother is a single parent. Uh-huh. And so she raised my grandmother, she raised my mother and was responsible for my great-grandmother also, mm-hmm. even though she had two brothers but they did not contribute to the welfare mm-hmm. of my great-grandmother. It was all put on my grandmother's shoulders.
She was doing two sides of generations.
Yeah. And my grandmother worked outside of the home.
What's your grandma's name?
Concha Gonzalez.
Okay.
And my great-grandmother raised me till I was about five. Then when I was five, my mother got pregnant, and because our little family was growing, my mom and dad decided that it was time to move apart from my grandmother and my great-grandmother. And so every once in a while I'd go back and spend the summers with my grandmothers and take care of my great-grandmother, or she would take care of me, whatever. But I guess my biggest role model was my grandmother. Because she was such a strong woman. She worked outside of the home. She took care of us a lot of the time. Pardon?
What did she work?
She was a seamstress in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. She used to make all our clothes. Well, not only did she go to work 8 hours a day, but she came home and worked another 8 hours mm-hmm. sewing and putting together the clothes for my aunt, my great-grandmother, my mother. She even made shirts for my dad. And when the boys were little, she made their shirts and their pants.
Wow.
My dad had a hard time making it through. I mean, he was very bright, but he had no real schooling, and he went back to school and got his GED. And they always talked about how important education was, and I could see that at one point. Well, during by the time I was what? For a while, they were real poor, always scraping together the money, not having a lot of mm-hmm. money for the rent and for that kind of stuff. We lived in a one-bedroom house, and there was three kids at the time, three kids. So my parents had the bedroom with the baby, and then what used to be the dining room was mm-hmm. turned into a bedroom for myself and my other brothers.
You're the oldest.
And I'm the oldest. Mm-hmm. So my dad, after a while, he was always... He was too smart for what he was doing, so he was very unhappy in the kinds of jobs that he had. So he was always quitting his job, and so we always had a lot of problems. Also, my father, I had problems with alcohol, and so sometimes he'd just get up and decide that he was not going to go to work anymore, and so that was that. And so the person that really helped us a lot, and although his parents had money, mm-hmm. they owned a lot of property, and my grandparents, and they owned grocery stores.
In Texas?
No, here in California, because mm-hmm. They moved to California. My dad came to California by himself. He ran away from home when he was 14. And then I think my grandparents followed maybe 3 or 4 years later and settled in Boyle Heights in East Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And they owned a market that was on the corner of 4th and St. Louis, or somewhere around there, near them. There's a Catholic church on Soto Street, mm-hmm. and it was a couple blocks down from that. And when I was little, and I was born in a house that was across the street from Hollenbeck Park. Mm. But, okay, so then the person that really saved us was my grandmother, because once a week she'd come and she'd bring groceries to us, and she would, if it wasn't for my grandmother, we wouldn't have any clothes.
Yeah.
So I always saw her as a very strong and liberated kind of person who did what she wanted to do. It's really funny because she actually didn't. You know, my great-grandmother had a lot of control over my grandmother, and even though she was a an older woman, my grandmother, my great-grand, she still answered to my great-grandmother, and she never really went out. It's like once she had decided that she was going to be responsible for the family, she never went on a date. She never, no men friends or anything like that, because of course it was very, to begin with, she was accused of being a whore because she had had my mother outside of marriage, and so she had to live down that stigma. And I think my grandmother saw it as her role in life to prove to everybody that she wasn't, and so then she became the saint.
The provider.
The provider and the saint. And, but they all, my grandmother and my great-grandmother, I don't know, they ruled with kindness and gentleness. They never yelled at us, and especially at me. They were always very kind and gentle toward me, and always encouraged me to go to school, and always encouraged me to be the best that I could be. I remember when I was little, I never had any problem with language, because I was bilingual by the time I was three. Mm-hmm. I would translate TV programs for my great-grandmother. And and I remember when I moved away from their home and I started going to school and spending a lot of time away from my my grandparents, my grandmothers, my mom and dad spoke English to each other. And I told my, and of course I was now speaking English at school a lot, so I came back and I told my grandmother, well, I think I'm losing my Spanish. And she would say things, well, only dumb girls do that. And you know, and you'll show me how smart you are if you don't forget your Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so of course the next week I of course told her that I had not forgotten my Spanish.
I didn't forget
and I'm smart. So I don't know, I had a lot of backing and a lot of support from them to do whatever I wanted to do. And they did strange things. For instance, my grandmother never taught me how to sew. She refused to teach me how to sew because she didn't want me to spend any time in sewing in factories or anything like that. And they always encouraged me to read, and they wanted me to work in a bank or to work in an office of some kind. They didn't want me to be working in a factory.
Mm-hmm. Give me the hope.
Yeah. And my dad, I don't know, I think he just had a hard time coping. He still does, poor guy, but he had an idea in his mind. I think he believed in education, but he didn't know how. And like I guess so many of our parents don't know how to encourage us, instead of giving us positive encouragement, or it's always backhanded, or it's always, it's not there. So even though my father used to say read a book, he never did. Mm-hmm. And even though my father used to say go to school or go to church, you know, he never did. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, he did go to school eventually. He went to school, he graduated from community college, and he worked for the state and finally got a job that he kept hung on to, and you know, they bought a house. We lived in the projects for a little while.
The East LA projects?
Mm-hmm. I lived in Pico Gardens. Mm-hmm. Before it became a war zone. And so while we were in the projects and while we were on welfare, my dad was going to school.
And your mom worked outside the house?
Or no, my mom was a housewife. Mm-hmm. All the time. She always worked at home. She had six kids.
Lots.
She had lots of kids. I always knew what I didn't want to do. I always knew that when I was out there hanging all those diapers on the in the projects and watching all those people around me doing the same thing, that I didn't want to be stuck in the projects for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Because I had a facility with languages, and what happened was that I was bilingual when I was little. And somewhere around the age of nine, I had a cousin that came from Mexico to visit. And when she left, I just decided that I was going to write to her, and I had no formal training in reading or writing Spanish, but I just started writing to her. And I asked my grandmother if what I had written was correct, and she said that it was. And just because Spanish is so easy, it just came to me naturally to be able to write it correctly and choose the correct spelling and grammar. And it sounded right, and so I did it. So at around about that time, I decided that, well, my grandmothers had told me that, you know, maybe you should do something in languages. And so I decided at that point that I wanted to be an interpreter. Mm-hmm. And when I went to high school, I studied French because I figured, well, I already knew Spanish and I didn't need to learn that I would study French. And I did quite well in that area, and I had decided, well, I'll be an interpreter, I'll go to Cal State San Francisco, because at that time they had one of the best foreign language departments in the California State University system. And I thought I'd go 2 years to community college, because we didn't have the money, and that later on I would go transfer into the college. So I already had that planned out.
So the family stayed right in East LA, and you went to grammar school and junior high? And
we kind of flip-flopped all over the place. Started out in East LA. Mm-hmm. In 1955, we moved to South Central Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I went to a Catholic elementary school, and then I did a couple of months at St. Mary's Academy, which was a four-year high school. Then we moved to the projects. Mm-hmm. And when we moved to the projects, I transferred to Hollenbeck Junior High School, and I went to Roosevelt High School. Mm-hmm. And graduated from there. And I can't say, a lot of people can turn around and say, well, they had a teacher that pushed them. Mm-hmm. I think I was left to fall into the cracks. There was all the good study skills that I had gotten during my time at Catholic school went down the tubes in public school, because there was nobody there to push me. My father was busy going to school. You know, he didn't pay any attention to the family or out gallivanting. My mom didn't know anymore. She only went to the eighth grade, and so she couldn't really help us. So if I brought homework, good, and if I didn't bring homework, that was good. So I kind of skated through high school. I got C's and didn't really apply myself, and was able to come out of there with a C average without ever studying a damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of
scary.
Kind of scary, yeah. So, you know, if a lot of the stuff that I learned when I was in elementary school. That's kind of sad. Kind of sad to say. It's an indictment against the school system that they let people just get by, mm-hmm. you know, and then it happens to people who have some skills and who have some bright, and some people who don't, and then of course there are the kids who don't and who need help and who really slip through the cracks. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the line, when I was in the 12th grade, I was seeing this guy, and he says, you have to fill out this application. So this was 1968, 69. So I graduated winter 69, so it must have been in the latter part of 1968. He brought me to this place called the Educational Clearinghouse that was located in East Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He says, the best thing that you'll do for your future is fill out this application. So I filled out an application, and I don't even remember what all was on it, but I was graduating. It was around January, February of 1969, and people, recruiters from Cal State Long Beach came and plucked me and said, you know, basically they said we needed bodies to be on the campus, and this is a way for you to go to college and get all your expenses paid. You got to realize that at this point I had, you know, 2.0 grade average and
no way of knowing how you were going to make
potential
it.
But nothing, no money. Parents on welfare, and with that kind of a grade point average, no hope for a scholarship of any kind. Mm-hmm. So,
what was Long Beach building up their student body? Or
they had just started the EOP program. Mm-hmm. I think the semester before.
Mm-hmm. So this was
1969. Yeah. So in summer, I guess not the summer, but fall of 1969, we were like the first 13 students. Actually, I guess the second group of EOP students, but the first group that had been there did all the recruiting for the second semester.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave us full funding, grants and loans, and I guess they put together all kinds of financial aid for us so that we lived in the dorms. God, I'll tell you, it was such a, and then my father was weird. I had to be home by 3 o'clock, so there was no extracurricular activities. And
mm-hmm.
Walking to and from Roosevelt High School, I had to make it in half an hour. I had to be home by 3:30, come hell or high water. Help. No matter how cute you wanted to look in your high heels, I had to be home in half an hour right after school.
Fast.
Yeah, learn how to walk fast and take care of the kids and do all that stuff. So if I went out on a date, which was rare, I had to be home by 10:30, 11 o'clock. And so there was this real tight rein around me to, it's very sheltered and very, my parents were also very conservative. You know, they talked about Cesar Chavez as being a communist and, you know, what do these people want and that kind of thing. And so I had a very conservative mindset when I was coming out of high school. You know, when I was in my last year in high school, during, well, of course, at Lincoln High School and at Garfield and at Roosevelt, we had a lot of walkouts, a lot of riots and that kind of thing. And I was always too afraid to join because my dad would kill me if I had gotten caught, or, you know, people were being threatened with, if you participate, you won't graduate. And so, you know, I had one of my best girlfriends, her parents were actually communists and they were involved in a lot of politics in East LA, and they, well, Tanya was very involved with the Chicano movement, and she would always come and try to talk to us, and there was a group of about five of us girls who always hung together, and when Tanya started getting politicized, you know, we shunned her because we didn't want to have anything to do with her, it didn't concern us, it was kind of strange. And then, of course, her mom and dad were quite active in East LA politics, and
what's your last name?
Mount. Mm-hmm. The Mounts. But they were actually communists, and they were involved with the Communist Party, of course. But they were also involved in a lot of the Chicano programs, organizations. In fact, they were involved with MALDEF when it first began, when they first got it together. They had no office space, and they helped put it together. So when I went to college, at first I did not want to, you know, I was there on the EOP, and all these people were talking about Chicano power and talking about the movement and talking about all this stuff, and I just, you know, that's not for me because I'm here to study. And
you were the first to graduate then in your family from high school?
No, my dad graduated from high school. He went back to school and graduated. In fact, I was 15 years old when my dad graduated from high school. And on my dad's side of the family, several of his brothers and sisters all graduated from high school. So it's not a first. It's just that my father was my poor dad. He's just, you know, not prepared to deal with being a parent, and not prepared to deal with, he's just stuck in a cycle. And couldn't get out of it. Still can't. But anyway, I still love him.
He's dad.
Yeah. So, getting onto the campus and dealing with all these people is really different. And being in the dorms and being independent and being having to deal with all the stuff. And I think the funniest story, or the worst part about that EOP program, was that they didn't really train us. They didn't tell us a lot of stuff. And, you know, you may think I'm stupid, but when I went the first day on campus, the bells didn't ring. Nobody told me the bells were not going to ring at 8 o'clock. So I missed my first class.
Like, when is that?
And I went downhill from then. I was not prepared to go to college. You know, they didn't have a summer bridge. They just threw me in there, and so I was expecting the bells are going to ring at 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock.
It's
like,
not written anywhere. No one says it.
So nobody says it. So unless they train you that you're responsible to go to class when you're supposed to. So I was there like a big pendeja. So I missed my first class, and from that point on, it was downhill all the way. I did not do well in college.
So you moved into the dorms, and everybody lived there together?
Moved in. It was strange. There was seven girls. Well, there was a group of us. There was some black kids, and there was some Chicanas, and there was some Chicanos, and some Chicanas. Mm-hmm. Chicanos, rather. Black. There was 13 altogether EOP kids, minorities. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't put us in the dorms on campus because they were full. And so what they did was they put us on the off-campus dorms. Mm-hmm. The off-campus dorms, you gotta realize, had a lot more independence, mm-hmm. because you were not
less regulation.
Yeah, less regulation. It was a big mess. So they gave us all these papers to sign, right? To have your parents sign for the, so that you could have a key to open the front door. And so, you know, I just slipped all these papers at my mother, and she just signed all these things.
Were they excited?
My parents were, I guess they were torn. With yes, they wanted me to go to college, but no, they didn't want me to go away. And yes, I was too young. And no, you're going to be out, you know, that whole, you're going to be out there whoring. Just, you know, yeah. They go from one end of the spectrum to the other, and it doesn't make any sense. You know, in your mind, you're going, God, you know, can't you trust me? And it's kind of weird, the things that we have to deal with, I think, as Chicanas, with parents. When I was young, 1967, around there, go-go boots were the thing. It was little white, short mm-hmm. go-go boots. Well, of course, yeah, everybody wanted go-go boots, but I could not have a pair of go-go boots because only whores and prostitutes wore go-go boots. Mm-hmm. This is the gospel according to my dad.
Mm-hmm. So did you have some or no?
In the end, I got some boots.
But you didn't wear them in front of him.
But no, I wore them in front of my dad, but you know, he just couldn't get over the fact that I wanted to be like a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was a questionable woman moved into one of the places next door, and she was always wearing these thigh-high boots. And she had questionable business practices. And so, of course, that proved it, you know, that here I was trying to be like this woman. Anyway, so.
Well, you could have said, at least I don't have those thigh-high ones.
That's right. So it's just, you know, little things like that that you have to deal with, and they come out of left field. I mean, as for a 15-year-old girl or 18-year-old girl, and people are throwing these things at you, you wonder, like, where does it come from? You know, why would they say something like that to you?
Well, you don't really understand what it means, all that means, for any reason, anyway.
Yeah, and I was very naive. I was very mm-hmm. sheltered. Mm-hmm. I was just, you know, just a big pendeja. When I was 18, I had to tell you another silly story. Because of my training through the church and my grandmother and not being exposed to nothing, I'm 18 years old, and my mother says, my mother told me when I was 10 about my period, mm-hmm. which is something that my great-grandmother never did for her. Mm-hmm. And my mother started her period, and my great-grandmother laughed at her. My mother thought she was dying. Mm-hmm. And my great-grandmother thought she was laughing and told her that she was a woman now and that she should not play children's games anymore.
This is your great-grandma to your mom?
To my mom, no, because my grandmother crossed the border illegally twice to come to the United States and work and send money back home mm-hmm. to support them. Anyway, that's a whole other story. So when I was 10, my mom told me about all this stuff. But what did she tell me? She told me that at a certain time in your life, somewhere between the ages of 10 and 13, 14 years old, you're going to start your period, and this means that you bleed once a month. Period. Hmm. Not why, not, you
she
know.
She's the bridge, though, between two generations.
Yeah,
she
wanted me to know, but I don't know if my mother knew why, 6 kids later. But, and I honestly really believed that you had to be married to get pregnant, to have babies.
Yeah.
And so all during my teenage years, you know, I was really super, super naive. Mm-hmm. 18 years old, and I'm sitting in the health class, and you know that mandatory health class? God, it opens your eyes. I was sitting there, and I go, oh, well, that makes sense. Oh, you know, all of a sudden, all that stuff fit together, and it made sense, you know. And God, even to this day, my mother won't talk about sex mm-hmm. to me.
Did your grandma ever say anything?
Oh God, no. Are you kidding? My grandmother made me wear a girdle so that my hips wouldn't shake. So I wore a girdle until I was about 18 years old, until I left for college, and I never wore another dress again, out the window. But yeah, so that your hips wouldn't shake, and so that men wouldn't look at you.
That makes sense.
And of course, you know, she never had it was never explained why my grandmother never had, in fact, from my grandmother's lips, I have never heard why she didn't marry my grandfather. Mm-hmm. I've gotten that story and that history in bits and pieces from my mother, who got it from my great-grandmother, who got it from, you know, my mom got from different aunts and uncles who, after she became an adult, told her my grandmother's story. Mm. So to this day, you know, then my grandmother had this idealistic view of love, or this is which her claim to fame, that she had loved once madly in her life and that she would never love again. So, you know, those kinds of things kind of...
They're pretty permanent.
They're permanent, and they kind of, you know, shade the way you look at life, and, you know, you figure that your grandfather had died, or, you know, you don't think about it, you know, as a child, you know, you don't question things, and so it's just accepted. Anyway. After the first couple of days, all the stuff that the people that it was UMAS at the time, United Mexican American Students, were talking about started making sense. It just, you know, they talked about the plight of the farm worker. And
so UMAS was organized by the time you got there?
Oh yeah, UMAS was already there. And so they were the people that were helping the EOP people.
They organized that Dia de la Raza and started getting EOP, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they were, of course, they got us onto the campus and they wanted us to be indoctrinated, and so they started indoctrinating us. And they all worked on us little by little, and there were so few of us there that it was easy to do. And I think the group, it was really funny that the group that they got onto our campus, onto Long Beach State, we were totally out of it. I mean, we were just on the fringes of of naivete and of
young.
We were young, but we had not even been involved in the walkouts.
Mm-hmm.
See, so they picked up people that that had not participated in some of those things, mm-hmm. and were not aware. So they, I was trying to remember all the girls that were part of the group that just, you know, we were just, I guess, like that little invisible kids that in high school, you know, the part of the masses that are, you know, we don't belong to any groups, and we don't belong, we're making quasi grades and not troublemakers, when we don't make a lot of noise, we just kind of glide from class to class. And so there we were on campus. And all of a sudden, with all this newfound freedom, and oh, the other thing that they did to us.
Living off campus.
How far was on the third floor of the men's dormitory.
Was the women's building?
No. We were on the third floor of, there was two women's buildings off campus, mm-hmm. and the men's dormitory. And because they didn't have enough men in the off-campus dorms, the third floor
mm-hmm.
was the men's wing, actually. Yeah, it was a men's wing, and the other half of the building, the one wing and the bridge,
mm-hmm.
were rooms. This was all women's,
mm-hmm.
but that the third wing was men's. And they put all these minority kids on the third floor of the men's wing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really funny, because before we had keys to get in, we could go in through the guys' rooms upstairs, because they could go through their windows, because we were on that floor.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of strange. We felt that they had discriminated against us, because the people who were in those dormitories were the wealthier kids,
mm-hmm.
the snobbish kind. I mean, they had put one of our girls into a room, and she had this Gavacha roommate,
mm-hmm.
and Irma had gotten into a room, and she was there one of the first days, and she was arranging her room, and then this white girl comes in, and she's got her skis in one hand and the beach bag in the other hand, turns around, looks at the room, looks at these three Mexicans in her room, and throws down the skis in disgust and the bags, and she says, "What are you doing in my room?" Kind of thing. Well, you know, I'm your roommate. Oh, no, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Turns on her heels and walks out. At that point, you know, we thought, oh, God, kind of bizarre. So turns out that, you know, they've got all these snobby rich kids in the off-campus dormitory. It was horrible. It was worse. This is like the first time I had ever had blatant discrimination thrown at me. Because, you know, here in California, it's all pretty behind the scenes and kind of underhanded.
Well, you grew up in your own neighborhood.
Yeah, and I grew up in my own neighborhood, yeah. But even so, as opposed to the South and mm-hmm. Texas, mm-hmm. where you know who your enemies are, mm-hmm. you can, in California, it's more difficult to tell who's a racist and who's not. So in that, when you grow up in that kind of environment, when somebody slaps that kind of stuff at you, it's just like
in front of your face.
In front of your face, yeah. I mean, they're not hiding it at all. Mm-hmm. It was weird. So that was one of the pivotal experiences that said, you know what? Stop and think about what these people have been telling you, and stop and think of some of your experiences in school.